The character planted in the audience that you'd never expect to be on the payroll. And when she plays her big scene, she creates more heat than you could ever imagine. Now here's the secret. She's a stunt granny.
Welcome to a very special edition of Stunt Granny Audio. It's Eric Nelson with Dusty Giebank. How you doing, Dusty?
Oh, I'm excellent. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, too. I'm boisterous and everything.
Because we
have many things to talk about. Well, we have two things to talk about, and one sucks and one is awesome.
Woo! And the other one is Matt Hardy. Woo!
Guess which one. This is a very special edition of Stunt Granny Audio because Dusty and I are here to discuss the Stunt Granny 2nd Annual Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame Inductions. Oh, it's a beautiful event.
Yes. I love that we've named it after Akeem, but we didn't even make him an automatic bid last year. He had to go through the second round of voting. We're just idiots. So.
Not to mention that it's also the Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame.
Yes.
The man who played Akeem is certainly not dead.
No, he's absolutely not dead. He did a couple shoot interviews. He is live and kicking.
That's right. Well, we've got the whole place decked out in yellow and blue streamers for Akeem in memory.
George Gray. That's his name. George
Gray. Okay. There you go. Well, if you Wikipedia him, you know he's still alive. But we're going to talk about the 2nd Annual Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame here in just a little bit.
Yeah.
We might as well get the other bullshit out of the way first.
Okay, good.
Okay, so Matt Hardy is a fucking train wreck. Yeah, he basically, I think he's jealous of Amy Winehouse. He's decided to take her 27 years of existence and cram them into about the last 4 months of his existence.
Right.
He's been busted. This is the second time, as of Monday the 12th, the second time he was busted for DWI in, 3 weeks?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If not less. And of course, he's tweeting about it. He says, I was framed. I got a bullseye on the back of my head. I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. What is it? What is there to get to the bottom to when you put things in your body and then you operate some sort of vehicle?
I don't know, man. I don't know why Terry Reynolds is wearing such a short skirt, but I do intend on getting to the bottom of it.
So. I saw JR. I looked up and I could see. Oh boy.
The only thing to get that he's getting to the bottom of is a bottle of whiskey, apparently. I don't know what the hell this guy is talking about. He's just the white trashiest person ever. I don't know.
Yes, he is. And okay, so to summarize the whole story, we all know that he got into some sort of car wreck and ended up hospitalized for a couple of days, and he posted on Twitter and I think on YouTube that everything was fine.
Yep.
In fact, I think that was the post where he had talked about the blood trickling down his face was like semen from an angel or something like that.
An absolute life force.
Yeah. I think another absolute life force is Destrucity. I wonder if he's a follower of that, too. I think he was arrested for the DWI for that one, if I remember right. I could be wrong. I don't care. It's all blurring together for me.
Yeah.
And then this one, again, it was just Monday. He gets another DWI, and the story goes, this is according to ProWrestling.net, if anyone wants to corroborate this.
Mm-hmm.
He was in an airport, and I guess he was driving, and because he was driving somewhat erratically, he was asked to pull over.
Mm-hmm.
And airport security, something along those lines, I don't know if they reported him to the police. Like I said, go to ProWrestling.net for the details, but, you know, because he was parked, he wasn't, I don't know, there's something about how he wasn't driving, but he was intoxicated. he was arrested and charged, but he was released on his own, you know, recognizance or whatever they call it, as long as he promised to just show up in court. And apparently he failed. He blew a 0.0 for his breathalyzer, but he also failed every sobriety test they could throw at him.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, as a fellow bow-legged person, it's not fair to ask him to walk a straight line. But otherwise, I will refuse to vouch for anything else that he might have failed.
Listen, I could never draw a straight line with a ruler because it's all on how you hold it. The ruler doesn't help any.
Yeah.
So no. Little things like that always bother me. No one's going to be able to walk a perfectly straight line.
That's right. You know what? I guess he's from Cameron, North Carolina. Of course he doesn't know the alphabet, forward or backward.
He doesn't know it the right way, let alone backwards.
He signs his contracts. They look like my girlfriend's, like, four-year-old niece. She tried to write happy birthday on an envelope the other day, and she wrote H-A-A-A-A-A-A-A-A-A. And I have a feeling that's what Matt Hardy's contracts look like.
That sounds like most of his promos. I don't know.
Matt Hardy when I die. Matt Hardy version 1.0.
ROH! 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 Oh, you fucking idiot. They're going to take you now. That's welcoming. Welcoming you, he's got one hand to hug you with and one hand on the tennis racket.
That's awesome.
Open arms now.
Yeah. God, that'd be great.
With arms wide open.
He's about as good as that song. Matt Hardy is the Creed of professional wrestling.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Very good.
I never thought we could make an analogy like that, and I know Nickelback technically is the worst band, and they're much worse than Creed. Creed had like a couple of good songs on one album.
Yeah. Mhm.
But you know, Matt Hardy had a couple of good matches in his career. I think Jeff was his tag team partner in all of those.
And just like with Creed, it was about a billion years ago.
And yeah.
Much tarnishing later, you know. So
there you go. There's the latest on Matt Hardy. No redeeming qualities in the man. You know, he even said he posted that suicide video.
Yeah.
And then
that
came back and said
suicide video. He never said heaven or hell.
Oh yeah.
What are you talking about?
That's what qualifies it as a suicide note. Of course.
When you mention the word heaven, that means suicide.
Yeah.
Don't you know nothing, man? Hey, mister, can't you read?
That's awesome. I don't even know what to say to that, but that's awesome.
All right, next.
Next, okay. So, like I said, second annual Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Dusty, talk about the four categories that we split this thing into.
All right, we're talking about serious wrestlers, and when we're saying serious wrestlers, I mean, you know, like for their contributions in the wrestling ring, basically. We're not necessarily looking for good work rate, just overall contributions in the wrestling ring, you know, and it can be talking too, and the angles they performed, executing them well, that sort of thing. That's what we're looking at there.
Great.
Second one is fun wrestlers, and that's your gimmick, guys. Last year, like Evil Doink the Clown and Akeem were among the inductees, so that's what we're looking for there. So fun, people that made watching wrestling fun.
Yeah.
And then the last two are pretty straightforward. It's just angles and matches.
Yep, absolutely.
What we enjoyed the most in those categories.
That's right. And we go through a pretty rigorous voting procedure, too, where we each nominate five, and by each, I think this year it was you and me, Jeremy and Kevin, Dan and Jordan.
Yep. And then I've brought in a super secret seventh person to do some tiebreakers. So.
That's right. Because you never know which nominee is going to cross the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was trying to, I'm like fishing to see who the actual, I don't know who it is. So. A little expedition there.
This guy has a name reminiscent of a Bobby the Brain drinking buddy.
Oh, God. I'll have to think about that one for a little while.
Okay.
All right. I'll put that on the back burner for now. We each nominate five wrestlers, and we just see who makes the majority of the ballots. Of course, with six people voting, you know, majority is a subjective matter. So if it made it onto three ballots, four ballots, what have you, then they automatically got into the Hall of Fame.
Right. But if you didn't get an automatic bid, then you could put through a stringent second set of voting.
Yep.
Or you had to get four out of the seven.
Yes, so there you go. Majority rules in that case. And what we come up with is the 2011 inductees for the Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame. Let's talk about the serious wrestlers first. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 acts. So I guess there are a couple of tag teams in here. You know, one guy who didn't make it in last year, and I'm not – I shouldn't say I'm surprised, but it's a good thing he got in this year or else this Hall of Fame would be a farce. Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, absolutely. The greatest professional wrestler of all time.
And if you don't believe Gorilla Monsoon, then who are you going to believe?
No, what did he say? The greatest professional athlete
in the world
today. Yes.
But if you're going to pick anybody who's contributed as much as, to this business as anybody else has, who's drawn as many people to arenas, who had a long-lasting legacy, who sold tons of merch, and who Joe on the street is going to recognize, 9 out of 10 people are going to know who this guy is as a professional wrestler. It's Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, if you set up a booth on Main Street and just ask people, hey, who do you think of when I say the word wrestler? And they're going to say, well, it depends on how old they are, first of all.
Sure.
But most of them are going to say Hulk Hogan. If you're a little bit older, you might say Gorgeous George. If you're from Northeast, you might say Bruno.
Right.
You might say Andre, but most people are going to say Hogan.
Yep, absolutely.
He just is flame to so many people.
And another inductee, the same kind of conversation happened when this guy passed away earlier this year, the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Yep.
You know, he's a hell of a wrestler, too, and a hell of a promo, fun to listen to. His angles were great, but he might be another one.
All-around performer ever, really.
He may very well be. Absolutely. Who else could carry Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior to fantastic WrestleMania matches throughout his career? But he's another guy who I would probably put him in the top 10, I would say, of wrestlers who, I guess, like I said, the average Joe Q six-pack would recognize as a pro wrestler.
Sure, absolutely. You know, if you're making them name 10, most of them are going to say Savage at some point.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
A newer guy who's making a name for a newer relative to Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, but a guy who's making a name for himself in the mainstream, Chris Jericho, another great wrestler, great promo, great angles, especially in the last, 3 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He really came on. He can be serious and funny. And he's very close to mainstream Hogan-esque star, about as close as we've gotten in this day and age.
I mean, there's a whole audience of people who would have never known who he was that recognize him from Dancing with the Stars from last year.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking about a whole female demographic who watched him on that show, who probably watched him on Ellen after he was eliminated, or watched him on, you know, Jay Leno or whatever else he was on. I mean, he's
on VH1 all the time.
VH1, all the talking head stuff that he's done.
Poster for him. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Game show host for a little while, that show Drop Off or Drop Down Menu or whatever it was called.
Mm-hmm.
But that's out of the ring and in the ring. I mean, he's kind of the anomaly here. If you look at the wrestlers who were inducted last year and this year too, He got, you know, the latest start of the bunch, like 91, 2, 3, whatever it was, in a class full of guys who were around in the 60s and or 70s and 80s.
Oh, yeah. So the first of the new bunch to make it, interesting that he got in before some of the other ones.
Yeah, definitely.
Well deserved. I'm not knocking him.
Yep. Oh, no, definitely. He definitely earned it. One of our personal favorites, Jerry the King Lawler, makes it in this year.
Yeah, my personal favorite of all time.
He's probably one of my two or three.
Obviously, I've been pushing for him for 2 years, so it's nice to nice to see him get his due. Absolutely.
Yep. And here's a guy, like you said earlier, you know, work rate isn't everything. And here's a guy that kind of exemplifies that. But he also, it depends on how you define work rate.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's if you like flippy-do, high-flying, you know, 360, death-defying athletics, he's not for you. But it's the little things. Memphis was very big on the little things, you know, conveying emotion and selling and stuff like that. You could be in the very last row of the Memphis Coliseum, and he could have his back to you, and you would know exactly the expression on his face just by how he was carrying himself.
Exactly, exactly. And if there's ever a guy who could work a right hand for 20 minutes, it's Jerry Lawler. And still sell out a 12,000-seat arena every week for 7 years.
And once again, another guy who could do funny just as easily. I fell in love with him SummerSlam 93. He was fucking hilarious.
Yeah, and the thing is that he was a heel, too, and he was trying to be an evil heel.
Right.
And yet, if you have the sense of humor that we have, you're rolling around on the living room floor laughing at how great this guy was.
Him getting stretchered off.
Yeah.
With his fist up.
Yes.
Like he was Joe Theismann, you know. Just had his neck snapped and he's getting hauled off of the football field, but I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
Oh my God. So great. And one thing, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, and it's a tactic he's used 1,000 times and so have other wrestlers, but man, I was already a Jerry Lawler fan in 94 when I saw him at a house show in Des Moines, Iowa wrestling Duke the Dumpster Drozzi.
Oh, God.
And Duke won, I'm sure.
Duke will not be inducted next year, by the way.
No, sorry, no. Lawler used the fake chain throughout the entire match, which was brilliant, too.
Yeah.
God, it was great. But then at the end of the match, you know, he's slowly making his way back to ring or to the backstage, and we're booing the shit out of him, right? So he grabs a microphone and he says, "If I hear one more peep out of you, I'm never coming back to this stinking town." And we all boo the hell out of him again. And
awesome.
And with the mic, he says, yeah. And then he says, "Well, just for that, I shall return." And everyone just goes ape shit. Just a brilliant. Oh, my God. But he's overdue. The Hall of Fame's been around for 2 years, and Jerry Lawler's overdue.
Mm-hmm.
One of Jerry Lawler's arch enemies over the years, Terry Funk, made it in this year. Another guy who, you know, made a 40-year career out of selling, basically, and just being crazy, crazy and old.
Drunken man, Weevil Wobble, and the flippity-flop thing between the second and third rope. Oh, my God.
The seesaw move.
Or, like, where he'll be staggering outside the ring, and he'll, like, yell at a fan and take a punch, but he'll trip.
Yeah.
Whoa. Kind of
that's thing. Great. Or Slamboree 94, he'll elbow drop that hat guy's hat.
Yes! I forgot about that!
Yeah. Oh, my God. He's in Philadelphia. What a... You know, he's already established himself in ECW, not to mention he's been a wrestler for 30 years. Now WCW comes to Philadelphia. And what does he do? But he tears apart the wooden stairs to beat Tully Blanchard over the head with him.
Mm-hmm.
He elbow drops straw hat guy's hat. He staggers. He throws punches. He's aiming at people. He's whiffing here. The guy's fucking incredible. And, like, you know, you mentioned the staggering cell. How many guys have stolen stuff from Terry Funk over the years? Like, you wouldn't have Dick Slater if there wasn't a Terry Funk.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Hulk Hogan. You can tell Hulk Hogan watched Terry Funk back in Florida. By the way, when he's laying on the ground and twitching one leg, that's a Terry Funk cell.
Yes.
Not to mention his promos.
Oh, my God. His promos against Dusty.
Yeah.
Oh.
You egg-sucking dog. You son of an unnamed goat, or whatever else you would say.
Yeah. And he's another one like Flair that held on too long. It's the disease of wrestling, I guess. You can't give up. But, you know, they don't hold that against him. I mean,
sure.
He's done enough good things where you can't blame him for getting in there at 60 and trying to do a moonsault. That's just...
Right.
That's what wrestling does to you, I guess.
That's true. Yep, absolutely. And it's a good thing he's not a financial failure outside the ring, or we'd be raking him over the coals for that.
It's still not okay to call Ric Flair's situation pathetic yet, though. I'll keep you updated on when it is. I'll let you know.
All right. T-minus one imminent death until it's okay to call a situation pathetic. Here's a good selection. I didn't put them on my ballot, but they got voted in. And if I didn't vote them in, I apologize, because that means I missed a crucial portion of their act, and that's Jim Cornette. The Midnight Express was voted in this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're all inclusive here. This is Bobby. This is Stan. This is Dennis. You know, we'll put them all in there at the same time. No reason to be that specific. Great body of work. Totally innovated tag team wrestling. Dominated the whole entire 80s.
Mm-hmm.
They were in Mid-South. They were in Texas. They were in the Carolinas.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All over the place. Against a variety of opponents, they kept coming back to the Rock and Roll Express. The pest of rock and rolls wouldn't go away wherever they went, you know? I kind of find that endearing, you know?
Well, you know, that says a lot about the ability of an act or two acts or a team or two teams to be able to draw that much money against the same opponent, you know? But good for them. And the fact that they had Jim Cornette as their mouthpiece makes it even better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You couldn't ask for a better manager.
No. I remember Cornette talking in a shoot interview. It might have been with – it was either with Heenan or Percy Pringle. I don't remember which one, but he says that he'd been in the world-class territory for about 6 weeks when Fritz Von Erich finally saw him for, like, the first time or talked to him for the first time, and he said, "Hey, how do you remember all those promos you do? You got promos for Fort Worth and for Dallas and for Lawton, and how do you remember those?" And he was like, "Well, I just apply myself. I don't know."
Right. Well, he is very anal about everything. He wrote everything down. He's like what I would be if I were in wrestling.
Well, he said
down and remembered it, you know?
Yeah, and he said he would also try to come up with two or three different ways to say the same thing so he could just keep his promo going.
Yeah, they had a running bet in Texas. You can't keep your promos under 5 minutes, and he almost never would. But
oh man, great stuff from the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette. Here's an old school wrestler, Harley Race. If you ask him, 8-time world heavyweight champion. Classic of the 70s and early 80s. He's always talked about as one of the toughest guys.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. He's Harley Race, for Christ's sakes. But talk about some of his, I guess, redeeming qualities as a pro wrestler. And I'm going to jump the gun a little bit here. His promos were always interesting to listen to.
What's that?
I said his promos were always interesting to listen to.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. That was his biggest selling point. He was an awesome, awesome promo.
Mm-hmm.
Kabuki! Paul Jones, you and your army! Yeah. Somebody take the damn money.
Oh, that's the best. Somebody take the damn money.
Yeah.
That's
but
so awesome.
I saw him on AWA on ESPN. It was like 1990. It was late 1990, so he's already a million years old. And he's just carrying Larry Zbysko like he's a toddler, you know, through this mat and making it watchable. And
yes,
Zbysko was totally on autopilot by then, you know?
Yeah, and literally the tail end of Harley Race's in-ring career, because by 91 he was a manager in WCW.
Yep, exactly. This is one of his last matches, basically, and he's just leading Larry Z by the hand, and it was amazing, and he was selling, and he was doing the Terry Funk Weeble Wobble, and he was, you know, come on over here, you know, hey, Clue, we're going to brawl on the floor here, hello, you know, that kind of stuff. And, and it was just amazing. Ring generalship, that's what they call it. And
yes.
he had that in spades. So not an overwhelmingly great worker, but just a ring general, the kind of guy you could count on in
yep.
his prime.
And you know what? The NWA, the governing board of hundreds of territories across the world, trusted him to be the world champion and to wrestle
yeah.
anybody they could throw in front of him, and that's probably exactly why.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of world champions, Nick Bockwinkel, AWA
yep.
world champion, also makes it into this year's Hall of Fame.
Yep.
Great wrestler, great promo, interesting promo style. Always used the obsequious and the flatulence and supernatural and all these big words, $10 words that Bobby Heenan would just roll his eyes at and make fun of.
5 minutes later, he brings something else up, and I'm like, I'm still working on botulism.
Yeah. That's great. Oh, my God. I got a chance to meet him in the Hall of Fame in Waterloo, Iowa a couple of years ago. And he's a super nice guy, too. Just very approachable. You can tell him, say anything to him, and he'll get 10 stories for you. He'll tell you how to build a watch.
And then he'll tell you what time it is, because he's a
yeah.
nice guy.
Yeah, that's right.
I haven't seen a lot of his work, but what I've seen I really like. Seems a bit ahead of his time, I guess, as a worker.
Sure. He was his best-known matches, I would say, with the fans of our era, his match against Kurt Hennig, the 60-minute match against Hennig was a classic.
Yeah.
You know, we've probably seen some, most, or all of his matches against Hulk Hogan. You know, he was the heel champion when Hulk Hogan was lighting the AWA on fire.
Yes.
And, I mean, I've seen other matches of his. Yeah, I haven't seen, like, a great deal of the body of his work, but he was a hell of a wrestler.
Mm-hmm. And he stayed in great shape and wrestled for a long time. He wrestled into his late 40s, didn't he?
I think so, yep. And then was able to transition into the commissionership of WCW.
This wasn't Ric Flair wrestling into his 40s. This was,
right.
you know, actual prime for him.
Right, exactly. Leave him wanting more.
Yeah,
good pick there with Nick Bockwinkel.
Yeah.
Here's a good one, and I don't know if it was an over. It's about as much of an oversight as a Hulk Hogan would be. You know, we had our guys we wanted to get in the first year. Jerry Lawler didn't get in, but you know, you got your Ric Flairs, your Shawn Michaels, your Steve Austin. Along with Hulk Hogan this year, Andre the Giant makes perfect sense.
Absolutely, can't have a Hall of Fame without Andre. He's just so important to the history of professional wrestling. The kind of guy who could draw everywhere for years.
Yep.
And keep rotating him to different territories. And,
yeah, make him the special attraction and people will pay for him.
Yep.
And not just anybody could pull off the special attraction thing. Andre was beloved.
Yep.
You know, you felt for him, you were happy for him, you were excited, but, you know, if Killer Khan broke his ankle, you wept for him.
Yeah.
You know, he was also great to team up with your local babyface. You know, team him up with the Junkyard Dog or with Dusty Rhodes or something like that, and just money, just a license to print money. I think it was another Cornette interview where he talked about it was Bill Watts.
Bill Watts, yes, thank you. I was just
talking
about
yep, talking about you know, bringing him in for a week was a week of guaranteed sellouts.
Right. Yep, so I'll work with you. I'll let you have this guy. And in exchange for working with Vince, Vince would give him another week of Andre. So,
yep, exactly. So,
which,
who better than a guy who could?
Yeah,
yeah. Who than a guy who could consistently draw money for 25 years?
Mm-hmm.
The last act to make it into the serious wrestler wing of our Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame, the Fabulous Freebirds.
Guys who are hardly ever serious.
And as far as I'm concerned, this is all-inclusive, too. We've got Michael P.S. Hayes, Terry Bam Bam Gordy, Buddy Roberts, but then we've also got Jimmy Jam Garvin, who was one of the Freebirds that I grew up on. You know what? We've got
Diamond Dallas Page
and Big Daddy Dink in there, too.
Yes. And Little Richard Marley.
Oh, my God. Yep.
Yeah.
And Fantasia.
Fantasia, yep.
Fuck it, why not? The whole fucking game of Fabulous Freebirds. I mean, I don't really know what else needs to be said. They, you know, they revolutionized the sport. They were a huge draw. even before WWE went completely global. You know, they did the theme music thing.
That was the only place they were never on top was WWF.
Yep, they were there, and it was for a very short time. But, yeah, they were on top everywhere else they went. You know, everyone loves and remembers Terry Gordy for being so, you know, such an incredible pro wrestler for as young as he was. I mean, Christ, I think he started when he was like 15, and he was a star by 19 and 20. Died way, way before his time.
Yes, very sad what happened with Terry.
Yes, it was. And Michael P.S. Hayes, such a brilliant mind for professional wrestling. He's, you know, one of the three or four more influential people in WWE today.
Now, Bill Watts was originally wanting to get rid of Michael and just make it Gordy and Roberts. But they just liked Michael so much that, you know, they weren't going to give him up. And it turned out he kind of made their act by talking people into the building, you know?
Yep. Hey, you need that. You know what? He was like a player coach. He was like a manager, but he got in there and fought also.
Yep.
So there you go. You can't have a Freebirds. In hindsight, you cannot have a fabulous Freebirds without Michael PSAs.
Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't have clicked the same way. So.
Yep, definitely. All right. Stunt Granny Audio talking about the second annual Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame inductions for 2011. Let's talk about the fun wrestlers that we inducted. These are the goofy ones, the gimmicky ones that we remember and cherish from our childhood. The guys whose action figures that Dusty had, I currently have in my possession.
Oh, yeah?
I saw the box today, and I thought, fuck, if I just had, like, some brown wrapping paper to wrap this up in, I would have it back in the mail tomorrow. I touched the box that all your stuff is in.
Well, fuck, if one of us wins the lottery and we start a wrestling promotion, then we'll be neighbors, so.
That's right. So, there you go.
Drop it off. Yeah.
Yep. So you mentioned that we've got the likes of Evil Doink and Akeem in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip ahead because this is actually interesting. The Big Boss Man made it in last year. Big Bubba Rogers made it in this year.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It just speaks to how good Ray Traylor was.
Yeah, well, it's true. He was. He was another guy who it's unbelievable how young he was when he died. When you look back and think, he was 26 years old when he was main eventing arenas and selling out arenas all around the country against Hulk Hogan as the Big Boss Man.
Oh, I know. He's the one that I'm most sad about dying for the purposes of a shoot interview. I feel like his shoot interview would have been really good.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point. He was in a lot of places and saw a hell of a lot of things.
Some of the wrestlers who died young probably wouldn't have been that interesting. I feel like Boss Man would have been really interesting.
Yes, very much so. I completely agree with that assessment. So, I mean, big loss no matter what, but yeah. And he was part of, I don't know if
how
you'd really consider him.
Really is.
Yep. I don't know if you'd consider him a part of the Midnight Express, but he was a member of that faction as Big Bubba Rogers. He was infamous at the time for not catching Jim Cornette when Cornette fell off the scaffold at Starrcade 86.
You're going to catch you like they catch the cheerleaders at the football game. Hey, Dusty.
Yep. He wasn't even looking at me. Anyway, that's so. Big Bubba Rogers, and then later on would wrestle Hacksaw Jim Duggan and nail him over the head with a sock full of silver dollars.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yep. Good stuff. Good memories. Another WCW wrestler from about that era. This is a great choice. La Parca makes it in for the wrestlers that we had the most fun watching.
Absolutely embodies everything we're looking for in this category.
Yep.
I fucking love that guy.
Yep. The chairman of the board of WCW.
I remember one match, he did the flare strut, right? He does this, like, robotic flare strut. Somebody was jumping off the ropes onto him. He caught them, slung them over his shoulder, and continued to strut around the ring.
That's fucking great.
Little things like that, man. Fucking hilarious.
Yes. The first time I got to see La Parca was the IWC AAA pay-per-view in November 1994.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a six-man tag team match. Jerry Estrada, I think Blue Panther and La Parca teamed up against Chris Benoit, Too Cold Scorpio, and Tito Santana.
Oh, shit.
And, of course, Benoit is in there primarily with Blue Panther, and those guys just did their thing.
Oh, sure,
so,
yeah.
That gave La Parca a chance to feud with his tag team partner, Jerry Estrada, and blow him off at every possible notice and tag him in when he didn't want to be tagged in and tag out when he felt like tagging out. And then clown around with Tito and especially Too Cold Scorpio in some of the most hilarious shit I've ever seen in a wrestling ring. So, I mean, just great pick overalls, hilarious. What a great outfit, too. He was basically wrestling in my Halloween costume from second grade.
He found a way to stand out. I mean, you know, this is especially handy when you're in WCW, and most WCW fans, most Americans, are probably racist towards that, you know? Like, oh, you know,
yep.
All these guys doing flippy-flop things, and here he is looking like that, you know?
Yep. Yeah, he was not a flippy-floppy luchador, but he definitely had a character that we could sink our teeth into.
Mm-hmm.
So, good job out of us. All right. Here's another great pick. I was actually skewing my ballot toward making this like the Randy Savage Memorial year. Sensational Sherry makes it into the Hall of Fame for the fun wrestlers category, and I totally agree with that.
But yeah. Absolutely.
What is it that separates Sensational Sherry? What is it that keeps her out of the serious category and puts her in the fun category?
You know, she did most of her best work after she stopped being a serious wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there was a period of time where they were trying to push a women's division, and they had her as the women's champion and the Jumping Bomb Angels as the main tag team. And most of the stuff that she did that was awesome was after that. It was the stuff with Savage and stuff that might not be as serious.
Yes, there you go.
She was very, you know, with that with Savage and doing those promos and stuff. That was great.
Yeah, she took it 100% seriously, but it came off so entertaining and so cartoonish. That's what makes it so endearing. You know, making herself up all garish. As Sensational Queen Sherry. Very Madonna and very just ridiculous, Cyndi Lauper looking. And then, you know, her brief stint with Ted DiBiase, which was nice. I'll always remember the fit that she threw when Howard Finkel at SummerSlam 91 said that Sensational Sherry had to go backstage or be suspended for life, and she just now starts screaming. And then her, you know, year or so with Shawn Michaels, singing the boy toy theme song and getting thrown down on the ground. And just a phenomenal.
Really helped Michael establish himself. That was a nice mix. The DiBiase one never quite clicked.
It was something for her to do, and from every account you hear Ted DiBiase give of their time together, he thought it was great. Yep, it really was. It was just kind of a blip on both of their career radars.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But, yeah, the fact of the matter is she is a phenomenal female worker in every sense of the word and was probably a better worker than 25% of the guys on the WWF roster at any given time.
If she were still alive, she could wrestle circles around the entire roster.
Yep, that's pretty much exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Another fun wrestler from when we were growing up, Kamala. But I think it was Jeremy who specified it has to be Kamala with Kimchi.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously you've got a 400-pound black man with stars and moons painted all over him.
Yeah.
And he can't speak English, and he just does a bunch of that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the ridiculous overhand chop.
Offense when I was a kid drove me crazy.
I know. Same here.
It just drove me completely insane watching him wrestle.
It was as bad as the Great Khali is today. It's just a big overhand chop, and that's it.
It's like some kick in the splash. He had three things. Jim Cornette jokes about Kevin Nash only doing six moves, and one of them is the flip the hair, but Kamala had less than that.
Yeah, he did. And yet we still remember him fondly. You know, his for some reason I always remember his feud with The Undertaker when he did that bug-eyed cell of Undertaker sitting up after three splashes.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started backpedaling down the aisle and tripped and fell, and I'm pretty sure he did that on purpose. That was just phenomenal.
Yeah, he did. He did. You can kind of tell. But,
I mean, he was just all about that character and just took it, you know, from the Ugandan headhunter to all the way to goofy, you know, clown and Kamala.
Yeah, when it was serious, it really scared me as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
Holy shit, you know, with the mask and stuff, like, whoa.
Yep, that's another sign of a good worker then. If he can pull it off as a babyface and a heel with a goofy character like that, then there you go. Here's a fun guy to look back on. Barry Horowitz, the winner.
Yes.
Barry Horowitz.
Yes.
Won, like, one match somewhere or other that might have been televised and then heads off to the Global Wrestling Federation to call himself the winner.
I love it. That's great.
You know, multi-year jobber for the WWF, gets his one little tiny push in the middle of 1995, has Ava Nagila as his theme music, he's wearing suspenders now, he's got a coat with a handprint on his shoulder for when he pats himself.
Dude, he got to captain a Survivor Series team.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And
that's
funny.
Ridiculous. God bless him.
That when you think of jobbers, you know, there are a handful. It's kind of like if you ask average Joe to name a few pro wrestlers, he would come up with Hulk Hogan, Steve Austin, The Rock, right?
Yep.
If you ask wrestling fans from our era, who do you think of when you think of jobbers, you're going to get Iron Mike Sharp. You might get Pistol Pez Whatley. You might get Dwayne Gill and Barry Hardy if you ask my dad.
Yeah.
But you're going to get Barry Horowitz.
Yep. Yep.
So, I don't know what else is that. Fuck, if he could win a match at SummerSlam 95 and then captain a team at Survivor Series later that year, I don't know what else I can say.
I don't know, man. He was doing jobs in Smoky Mountain. He just did jobs everywhere. That was awesome.
Yep. The original pin me, pay me right there.
Yep.
All right. Last inductee into the fun wrestlers wing. Coco Beware, who made it into the serious WWE Hall of Fame a couple years ago, and now here he is, and I'm assuming he's with Frankie, too. He's here in our goofy Hall of Fame.
Gotta be with Frankie. And, yeah, our Hall of Fame is a little bit more prestigious, I must say. So I'm sure he's much more honored today than he was back then.
I would think so. Well, he came up through the ranks of being Coco Ware, along with Norvell Austin, as the pretty young thing. In Memphis, and you know what? If he could do it at probably 55 years of age, he'd probably still be a pretty young thing today if he could.
Right. what infuriates me is on the new WWE DVDs, they've edited over Birdman with Piledriver.
Yeah. That irks me, because he was the Birdman for crying
right
out loud.
Right off, man!
That sucks about the classic theme songs. And everybody do the bird, bird, bird. Everybody knows that song.
Yeah.
One other thing about Coco Beware before we move on.
Mm-hmm.
One of his finishing moves, the Brain Buster, was called the Ghostbuster Suplex.
Yes, the Ghostbuster. Mm-hmm.
Anybody who could name their finishing move the Ghostbuster is all right by me.
Oh, yeah, I love that name. Mm-hmm. That's great.
All right. Yep, definitely. All right, we got quite a few of these to go through, so let's see how much or how little we want to talk about each one of them. But second annual Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame, the wings that involves the angles, the most memorable angles of professional wrestling. If they weren't the most memorable, they just happened to be our favorites or the ones that resonated with us the most. Starting with the classic from 1997, the Hart Foundation, Brett Owen, Jim Neidhart, British Bulldog, Brian Pillman, versus the entire country of the United States of America. What made this one so great?
You know what? This is what started the boom period in the late 90s. This, right here, this.
Mm-hmm.
You can trace it back to this. Bret Hart being pissed off about being screwed over so many times and saying, well, I'm still doing this for all my fans except for the ones in the United States. And coming out with Bulldog and Owen fighting each other and telling them to knock it off and get along again. You know, that was the start.
Oh, yeah. And then bringing in his old partner, Neidhart, and then absorbing Brian Pillman as a former Calgary Stampede wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the brilliance of turning Americans heel.
Yeah.
I mean, the Americans didn't take him as that, but, you know, you could be argued everyone else around the world did. But that was, I mean, that's a stroke of genius right there.
It was Jerry Lawler versus Vince McMahon in the Memphis feud. Basically,
on a
wider scale.
Yep. That's great. And that's a great template for future angles, too. I love to see that used appropriately more in the future. I think that'd be great.
WWE had every other pay-per-view in Canada that year and just tapped that market. How great was that for business, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. My God. And given all the wrestlers who were involved, there were a lot of great matches that came out of this. You know, it started after the Bret Hart Steve Austin match at WrestleMania, but it was a byproduct of that in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them had other singles matches that were really good too. But you know, you got other than the broken neck aspect of it, the Steve Austin Owen Hart match was great. The 10-man tag from Canadian Stampede was just a masterpiece.
Yes.
So you had good wrestlers cutting good promos with a great angle behind it and just crowd heat like you couldn't even measure.
Right.
So overall.
And it was real too. Bret and Shawn really hated each other, you know?
Yep. Oh yeah, definitely.
It really did take things too seriously. Everything was, you know, it was real. People could buy into it. So.
Yep. A lot of things firing on all cylinders about this angle.
Yep.
Well worth the votes. Let's see. In the NWA, Four Horsemen form in 1985, and they form over Dusty Rhodes' ankle. I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Ric Flair versus Nikita Koloff?
I believe so, yes.
In a cage, and then, so Dusty decided to come out and help Ric Flair by getting Nikita and the Russians out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ric Flair's buddies at the time were Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Ole Anderson, and they run down because they don't like Dusty.
Yep.
And what do you get but the Four Horsemen and a broken ankle on Dusty Rhodes? That's great. That takes, I mean, that's a brilliant transition from, it's the culmination of and the transition from so many angles into this one just brilliant thing.
Yeah. And just everybody is in a group now, you know?
Yeah.
There's how many groups and they can all be traced back to the Horsemen. It just.
Yep.
Was a new wrinkle in wrestling. I'm sure there were groups before that, but none as successful and popular.
Right, definitely. So good work. That's the origin story of the Four Horsemen. This one's basically just our sense of humor. But the Big Boss Man and Al Snow in 1999 feuding over the Hardcore title, and for whatever reason, Al Snow brings his little dog Pepper to the arena.
I don't think those reasons were properly explained by WWF, but...
Well, and I would assume part of the reason is because it was 1999 and Vince Russo was still in charge.
Well, that's the reason, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And
Which
so Big Boss...
was a low IQ, that's the reason.
And Big Boss Man kidnapped... To get Al Snow's goat, kidnaps Pepper and turns him into Pepper Steak and doesn't just kill the dog and turn it into food, but invites Al Snow over for a delicious dinner, even though they're feuding.
Why would
they're
Al say yes to that? Why?
No shit.
Why the fuck? You know what? You eating boy.
Jesus. And it
God
ends.
Damn.
It ends in a match that, okay, you know.
Greatest match of all time, yes.
Yeah, WWE took the cage match gimmick, which, you know, the jig was up on that thing years earlier. Cage is going to keep these guys in and keep everybody out. And I guarantee you the fucking 15 minutes into the first cage match in history, everybody on the roster was over the top of the cage.
There's like 50 guys climbing the cage, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So WWE decides to expand the cage to surround the entire ringside, plus put a lid on it.
Jim Cornette's idea, thank you.
Yep. First match, first Hell in a Cell match, Kane comes down and rips the door off the cage, off the Hell in
right.
a Cell. There goes that gimmick, but it still sells. So, you know, cool. I mean,
well, it sold Kane, which is what they want.
Yeah. So. Yep, exactly. So, what does WWE or WWF do in order to blow off the blood feud between two guys over the hardcore title that involves a dead dog being turned into supper?
Yep.
But put a steel cage inside a Hell in a Cell,
yep.
call it Hell in a Kennel, and yep. have it between two guys who are barely even mid-card wrestlers at the time.
Right.
They have the actual dogs inside the Hell in a Cell.
Found in the ring, taking dumps wherever, in the ring too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what do you get but an inductee into the Stunt Granny Akeem Hall of Fame?
Oh,
oh God.
So bad, but so good.
Yes.
Boss Man owned 1999, man.
Yeah,
he
between now. Out.
And then
yep.
last year we put in the Big Show angle. 1999 was an amazing year for him.
It was, absolutely. So, good job, Big Boss Man.
Woo!
Yeah. And Al Snow, way to ride his coattails into the Hall of Fame. Okay, Ric Flair, his retirement angle of 2008 made it into the Hall of Fame last year.
Yep.
It was the, you know, the career-threatening matches that led up to the match against Shawn Michaels where he retired in Orlando in front of 75,000 people.
Yeah.
It's not the only retirement angle Ric Flair ever put himself through. He did one in 1993 for WCW where, and the whole story, and you can elaborate on this, was Sid Vicious was supposed to wrestle Vader for the world title, and he got himself into a little bit of trouble.
Yes, he did. They were at a hotel bar, and Sid was bragging himself up, talking about how great he was and how he's the future of the wrestling business. And Ric Flair was helpfully pointed out to him, well, you're not very good. And Arn Anderson probably rubbed it in even more because Arn Anderson had a few drinks in him. As
yep.
was usually the case with Arn Anderson.
Yep, yep.
And Sid took offense to this because he was a 500-pound wrestler on the steroid rage. So they ended up having a shoot fight in the hotel, and Sid in his shoot interview says he doesn't remember ever grabbing the scissors. Just he was kind of blacked out with rage.
Well, O.J. Simpson said the same thing in his book about O.J. Simpson said the same thing in his book about murdering Nicole Brown Simpson.
Yeah, you know, there is a phenomenon where you kind
yeah.
of black out with anger. So I believe it, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's got the scissors and he's standing on top of Arn, you know. And
yep.
So that took Sid successfully out of the picture. And
yeah.
But the need for a new person to take on Vader. And
yep.
Ric Flair had just come back a few months earlier, I believe.
Yeah, it was June of 93. And
yeah,
I mean, if he
Flair
did,
for the old thing. Yeah.
The Flair for the old, and I think his first match back was August of 93. He and Arn Anderson against the Hollywood Blondes, 2 out of 3 falls, which was awesome.
That was the same one where Tom Zenk shot off the Bat Blaster.
Yeah, it sure was.
Yeah.
If memory serves me correctly.
Same show. Yep.
Yeah. And so, yeah, in an effort to sell Starrcade 93 with the new challenger, Ric Flair, on such short notice, the angle was that Ric Flair was going to put his career on the line. 20 years of a career on the line, and I'm going to put your head on my wall, Ric Flair. So there you go. And it
yeah,
was,
this was when Vader was super scary, and he was splattering Mick Foley's head across the concrete.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So you had, huge over heel monster, Big
yep.
Van Vader, against sympathetic, older, multi-time world champion, just made his comeback, Ric Flair.
Yep.
It culminated in one of my favorite matches of all time at Starrcade 93. So, yeah, definitely a worthy entrant into the Hall of Fame for the angle.
Mm-hmm.
Another great match that started with a very memorable angle, Randy Savage versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. We all remember the match from 1987, WrestleMania 3.
Mm-hmm.
But the angle that preceded it is probably the reason that people our age know what a larynx is.
Yes, that's how I learned it, yeah.
Yep.
I learned a lot of stuff from watching wrestling now that I think about it. But
I learned what ambidextrous meant from wrestling.
Me too. Yep. It was one of those classic WWF things where they book the match first, and then they book an angle to give them an excuse to have another match.
Yeah.
WWF used to do that all the time. So they were headlining a Superstars show or something.
Yeah.
And that's when Savage went with the ring bell, which is very memorable. And I know at least off the top of my head five people who started watching wrestling because of the ring bell.
Oh, yeah.
They have to turn it on, and, oh, there's the ring bell angle, and, you know, they were just, enthralled by it. So,
yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And just, the visual of Ricky Steamboat gagging and holding his throat as he's being stretchered out of the arena.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Steamboat selling. So good.
Yep, definitely. And Randy Savage was that, like, tightly wound coil that was, you know, ready to explode at the time.
Yeah.
He'd been around for about 3 years or maybe a little less. He was Intercontinental Champion for almost 18 months, however long it was. And, you know, it was like everything came together exactly right at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Good. I mean, there might have been a couple of corny promos of Ricky Steamboat trying to relearn how to talk.
Terrible stuff, but whatever, man.
It all paid off in the end, right? All right. Fast forward to 1991, and the WWF title is vacated. Hulk Hogan, as a three-time world champion, loses it to Undertaker at Survivor Series 91.
Mm-hmm.
Due to backstage shenanigans and WWE trying to sell an extra pay-per-view that week or whatever, they decide to have...
had his hands in that cookie jar.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They decide to have This Tuesday in Texas headlined by Hulk Hogan versus Undertaker. Undertaker loses the world title to Hulk Hogan. Jack Tunney, by the way, was going to be at ringside to make sure nothing weird happened.
Can we get a little Jack Tunney making that announcement?
Let's see. Let me see if I can remember the announcement he made for that match. Because I can do the whole, the snake had been devenomized by the lab.
Yes.
I'll leave it at that one because I can't remember his wording for the Hulk Hogan Undertaker thing.
Oh,
I will personally be at ringside, something like that.
Perfect.
And then he gets nailed with a chair. Jack Tunney does by WWE. I can't even talk. I'm so excited about this. WWF president Jack Tunney hit with a chair, knocked out. Comes to the next thing he sees is Hulk Hogan with a chair in his hand, and then Hulk Hogan gets the pin. So he takes it upon himself to strip Hulk Hogan of the title.
Yes.
And the 1992 Royal Rumble, 30 men will enter the Royal Rumble, and the winner will not only be the winner of the Royal Rumble, but also the brand new, undisputed WWF champion.
Yes.
And in the meantime, Rick Floyd...
stipulation that Hogan and Undertaker can only draw numbers 20 through 30, or 21 30 or something.
Yep. They were the two most recent world champions, so they get that little incentive. Ric Flair, brand new heel on the scene, bringing the NWA title to the company with him, proclaiming himself to be the real world champion.
Yes.
Already got fused with Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan. You can tell Randy Savage doesn't like him. draws number three. At a pay-per-view where Bobby the Brain Heenan was just at the absolute top of his game.
He might have literally been on fire. He was awesome.
I think so. Damn it!
Sit down before you have a heart attack.
Yeah. Don't jump. It's a long way down.
Can I get you a hot dog?
I know just how you like him. Heavy on the onion.
No, you're going to stay here.
Yeah. I got to find out what the number is. Number one.
Well, no, that wouldn't be fair to Flair. What would be fair to Flair is if he had number 31.
Yeah, don't start that fair to Flair stuff with me. God, everything about that angle from Survivor Series 91, the gravest challenge, Undertaker wins, to this Tuesday in Texas, the goofy offshoot pay-per-view. Hogan wins it back, even though Flair interfered. Flair's working his way into the roster. Jack Tunney is involved. Undertaker's there. All sorts of old world champions, Sergeant Slaughter, Randy Savage. You got the angle within the angle where Roddy Piper wins the Intercontinental title earlier in the show at Royal Rumble 92, and then comes in halfway into the Royal Rumble just when Ric Flair thinks he has his respite. And then for Flair to overcome the odds while he's got Bobby Heenan cheerleading for him on commentary, wins the vacated world title. I mean, that's like 3 months worth of storytelling that, you know, you can't, you know, that's worth all the money in the world.
It is, absolutely. Sid didn't win, but that's okay.
All right, a couple more. We can maybe breeze through these. Kerry Von Erich versus Ric Flair, Christmas 1982. Cage match where Ric Flair comes into the territory of NWA World Champion. You know, the top baby faces in world class at the time were the Von Erichs and the Freebirds.
Yep.
Michael Hayes is the special guest referee. You know, when the champion came to the territory, one of the kind of stories to go along with all the angles was that the territory wanted the belt.
Yeah.
And so Michael Hayes is thinking, beat Ric Flair and take the belt. Terry Gordy came in and slammed the cage door on Ric Flair's head, and Kerry Von Erich refuses to get the pin because he's the white meat baby face, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Michael Hayes is like, you idiot, you could be the world champion, you know, here right here in Texas, in your home state.
Yeah.
And Kerry doesn't do it. And then they make it look like Kerry pushed Michael, and then Terry Gordy slams the door in Kerry Von Erich's head.
Yep.
Ric Flair wins the match, and we're off and running with the Von Erichs versus the Freebirds feud.
Right. Which sold out everywhere and led to extraordinary business in Texas. So.
Yeah. Yep. All sorts of money to be made there.
Yep.
All right. I think that actually sums that one up.
Sure.
We talked about the Horsemen forming. Here's an angle with the Horsemen where Sting was a member of the Four Horsemen for a cup of coffee.
Yep.
And because he won the Iron Man Challenge at Starrcade 89 and gave him the right to wrestle the world champion, which was Ric Flair, the leader of the Four Horsemen.
Yep.
Sting is patiently waiting.
At the end of that pay-per-view where the Horsemen surround him in the ring.
Yeah.
And it looks for a brief second like they're going to attack him and kick him out then. But then they raise his hand and celebrate with him. Very good, very good job there. And Jim Ross did the exact right thing. You know what he did? Nothing.
Nothing. That's usually for being the best
for itself.
Yep.
So.
Yep. For being the best announcer in history, sometimes when he does nothing, it's the best thing he can do.
Exactly.
And so 1990 comes around. Sting decides he's going to wrestle for the world title, even if Ric Flair is the champion. And Ole Anderson just berates the shit out of him, and then they kick his ass and kick him out of the Horsemen.
Awesome promo by Ole.
Yep, definitely was.
And then
was.
Flair backs up his man and says, you know, we're just, you haven't gotten your ass kicked yet because I told them not to. You know, you should thank me for still being able to breathe. And
yeah.
Just amazing.
God. Yep, that's great when you got those guys cutting promos on a hapless guy like Sting. And he was popular as hell, you know, but they're all carrying this angle for him and he's doing, you know, he does what he needs to do. But to me, I will always remember Ole's promo on him. That is what made the angle for me.
Agreed. Very good.
So, all right.
Ole was an excellent promo.
He was, man. That promo that he cut on Thunderbolt Patterson when he was talking about how Thunderbolt just doesn't look like, you know, like he should be hanging out with Ole Anderson, but Arn does.
Right. Right.
Good stuff. All right, last but not least, Cowboy Bob Orton Jr., the ace, the guy that Roddy Piper is going to go play tiddlywinks with.
Oh, the one he'll never quit, yeah.
That's right, yeah. Bob Orton injures his arm at some point and wears a plaster cast to the ring for about 17 years.
Yes.
Bob
and you
Orton
know Joel Gertner Bob Orton must have been one of his favorite wrestlers because he copied.
Yeah, Joel Turner's probably still wearing that neck brace to this day.
Yeah.
You know, they tried the plaster.
I'm sure he's at some Walmart or something. But
probably. Well, he's probably in a hover round or a little rascal, you know, just for sympathy, not because he needs it. But he's probably wearing a coat with no shirt, a bow, and a neck brace with a bow tie on it.
Yes.
Carting himself around Walmart right now.
The reason he did that is because of Cowboy Bob the Ace.
Yep. And, you know, look at how that manifested itself over the years. Owen Hart did the cast thing for a few months in 96.
That's right.
D'Lo Brown brilliantly did the protective chest.
What do you mean, cast? I didn't wear a cast. What are you talking about, cast?
Yeah. That's awesome. D'Lo in the chest gear in 1999 was great.
So, a
good angle when used properly and you know, a good heel with a little bit of comedy to him.
Mm-hmm.
Always seems to work. That takes care of the angles. Let's see.
Matches. Here in the second annual Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame voting.
That's right. And we do have eight really good to great to awesome to very memorable matches to talk about here.
Yeah.
We talked about the Royal Rumble 92. I don't know what else there is to say about it. I'm surprised it didn't make it in last year.
Me too.
Ric Flair at number three comes in as the new heel in town and wins the whole goddamn thing, lasts an hour, wins the vacated title. In the process, manages to wrestle or touch all other than Ted DiBiase, almost everybody in the world that he's got some sort of history with.
Yes.
It was a who's who of wrestling at the time.
Perhaps a perfect 60 minutes in wrestling.
Yep, I think it probably was. And it told one of the best stories from beginning to end. Just a fantastic match. We also talked about Randy Savage versus Ricky Steamboat, but that made it in. Probably the first great match of the, I would say so, probably the first great match on a big stage of the modern era.
Sure. I could buy that.
You know, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat say that they had some great matches in 84, but not a lot of people saw them.
Right.
So I would have to fast forward all the way to 87 to say, like, for people of our era, that was probably the first great wrestling match that a lot of people saw.
Yeah, yeah.
And what it did for wrestling, I mean, you hear guys like Edge and Christian or people of that, you know, nature talking about how that match influenced the way they wrestled.
Yep.
There aren't a lot of matches that get talked about like that, so I think that's a very important one for that reason, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Very recent match. It was what, July? Was July Money in the Bank?
Yeah, just a couple months ago. Mm-hmm.
Yep. CM Punk versus John Cena in CM Punk's hometown of Chicago. Just coming off of the speech about how he hates WWE and it's run by a doofus and a dipshit.
Yeah.
And if he wins the belt, he's going to hightail it out of there. And you've got this guy who's like the king of independent wrestling who's finally making it in WWE. Against the guy who most everybody hates, but he's still a fucking good worker, whether you like it or not.
Right. Well, most people don't like it on the internet, but they're going to have to deal with it.
Yep.
Or stop watching wrestling.
Yep. One of the few matches that, you know, it was a main event for the world title that went like 30 minutes or 33 minutes or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And so sloppy and it's not the most technically sound match ever, but, you know, like you alluded to, it got by on emotion. It could have been horrible, and the emotion of the angle and the crowd and everything would still make it awesome.
If they would have had that match in Anaheim, California,
oh, shit.
We wouldn't be talking about it right now, I bet.
I can guarantee you that.
No. All right, so that one, very recent match that made it into the Hall of Fame already, and thank you to the Chicago crowd for helping out.
Yeah.
Randy Savage versus Ric Flair, WrestleMania 8, my personal favorite match of all time.
Yes, it is.
48,000 dumb Hoosiers in the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis. And WWE will say it was more, but it wasn't.
Right.
So Ric Flair had just won the world title at Royal Rumble 92.
Well, WWE will tell you there were more than 10 people at WrestleMania 9, and they're absolutely weren't.
They just had Oscar at ringside running around a whole lot to make it look like there were more people there.
This match was complete chaos. I loved it. You got Elizabeth at ringside and perfect interfering right and left and to and fro. And Flair's bleeding and they're cheating every second. It's awesome.
Yeah, Savage runs to the ring to try to attack Flair, chases him down the aisle, cheats to win. You got fireworks at the end. You got a great promo afterwards about every time I see Elizabeth, I'm going to kiss her on those soft, wet lips.
Woo!
Shut up, Mooney! Just great. Just a bunch of great stuff.
He told Mooney to shut up twice.
Yeah. Well, he earned them both, that asshole.
I'm surprised Mooney didn't hang himself that night, you know?
Seriously.
I hate
John. All right, all good stuff out of them. Mankind versus The Undertaker, King of the Ring 98. Mankind is thrown off the top of the Hell in a Cell, 16 feet through a table below, gets back up, choke slam through the top of the cage, gets back up, stumbles his way through a few stunts with thumbtacks and whatever else.
What's I remember one where... specifically because I had an ear infection that week, and I was watching this. I was watching this match through the prism of heavy medication, and I was just freaking the fuck out. You know?
Yeah. How could you not? I think my friend Scotto almost started crying during the match.
Sure.
I mean, this is like the first time that anybody in WWE had taken this much punishment all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's just etched into the history of WWE. You're going to see that big fall off the top of the cage in every montage from here to, you know, the end of time.
Yep.
So, you know, again, another one that's technically not a Matt classic, but, you know, from beginning to end, it told such a ridiculous story. And
yeah, I mean, to me,
emotion.
That's what it's all about, telling the story. You know, it doesn't have to be precision, you know, perfect execution on everything.
Yep,
so.
Exactly. All right, Rob Van Dam versus Jerry Lynn. Now, actually, I'm not too sure. This was definitely ECW. They had a couple of matches in 99, and I guess I was thinking this was a match from 99. I think if we went back into the annals, that I don't think they wrestled at Heatwave 98, but I know they wrestled at Living Dangerously and at Hardcore Heaven in 99.
Okay.
And so all I can really say about those is that they had, you know, looking back, I still remember those matches very fondly, and I remember thinking they were just, like, revolutionary at the time. I think they still hold up. You know, the guys today are still doing a lot of things that they were doing in those matches. Didn't need a lot of flippy floppy acrobatics. They were just two guys that were, you know, they were great at what they did. They knew each other well. They had moves and counter moves and holds and counter holds.
I mean, that's part of it. They worked together so often. They had a very good rapport with each other.
Yep. So yeah, I mean, pretty much any match those two ever had against each other was a good match. And they had a couple of great ones in ECW too. So.
And it was 99. The 98 is a typo.
Okay, gotcha. So, there you go. And Rob Van Dam could do no wrong at the time. He was like, you know, he was for ECW what Steve Austin was in 1997 and 98 for WWF.
Mm-hmm.
He was that guy that all the guys wanted to be and everyone thought was so cool and was saying stuff that no one else was saying.
Yeah.
He had his hand gesture.
Yeah.
There you go. Just cooler than the other side of Baron Von Raschke's pillow.
Nice.
Here's one. I've watched this match twice in the last month. Bret Hitman Hart versus Mr. Perfect at SummerSlam 91.
Yep.
I mean, it was the culmination of a mid-carder that we were all familiar with, Bret Hart, who'd come up through the tag team ranks and had a little taste of singles glory and was coming back for more in his first singles title.
And this was his first singles match on pay-per-view, I do believe.
Yes, I believe it was, yep.
And so this is really a coming-out party for him.
Yep, and here he is wrestling a guy who's been atop the mid-card and in the upper echelon, really. I mean, he's had a couple of, you know, Saturday night's main event, headlining matches, wrestled Hogan, wrestled Warrior, totally made a name for himself, but had that, like, death grip on the Intercontinental title, Mr. Perfect.
Yeah.
Just about to go into retirement because of a bad back. Of course, he get called out of retirement later, but, you know, either here or there at the time. And just two amazing technical wrestlers putting on a clinic in Madison Square Garden on pay-per-view, no less.
Yeah, hot crowd. Everything, the stars aligned for that one. Mm-hmm.
Yep. If I had one critique, it would be Coach. But Coach really, like, was kind of a non-factor in the match.
Yeah, I've argued this in the past. I mean, the coach's involvement was so minimal, I don't see how you can say it hurts.
No, it's true.
I think he had the right amount of involvement. He got knocked off the apron. He did the hilarious bump down. That was about it. That was all you saw of Coach.
Yep, that's true. So there you go. Great match. I'll probably watch it again here soon. Who knows? And
I'm going to watch it tonight.
All right, there you go. Last match, and this one was definitely on your ballot. I love the match, too, but I know you've always been a...
this was my pet project. I was trying to push this through last year and this year. I loved this match.
Yeah, it was great. War Games at WrestleWar 92, WCW.
Yep.
Sting's Squadron. Sting and Nikita Koloff, Ricky Steamboat, Barry Windham, and Dustin Rhodes against the Dangerous Alliance, Rick Rude, Steve Austin, Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton, and Larry Zbysko. Talk to us about this match.
Holy shit, how much talent is in that ring, you know? Everybody is at least passable to good to great, except for Nikita, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Nikita's a lot of dead weight, but still, I mean, look at all this talent. And this was the absolute zenith of Bill Watts' 1992 booking spree. This was the culmination. Shortly thereafter, the Dangerous Alliance blames Zbysko for the loss because Zbysko hit the turnbuckle on the wrong guy. So Zbysko got kicked out, and then all of a sudden, Rude and Austin and Medusa hung out on their own, and Anderson and Eaton started hanging out with Michael Hayes. So this was kind of the end of this particular line of booking. And just a tremendous match. Again, crowd emotion was at an all-time high, and you couldn't ask for a better set of workers except Nikita. So
you had a lot of investment in the baby faces, mostly, I think. You know, you've got the tenured Sting. You've got the tenured, even though he's come and gone a couple of times, Barry Windham. You've got the fairly new Dustin Rhodes, who's doing a pretty good job of getting out of his dad's shadow. You've got Ricky Steamboat, who's a veteran, and everybody loves him. And you've got Nikita, who came off hot angles with Sting and Lex Luger.
Yeah, and you've got the whole element. At this time, the Dangerous Alliance was kind of trying to get him in their group, so there was a whole lot of can you trust Nikita, which just adds to the drama.
And so you've got this great collection of baby faces, and they're all great for all different reasons.
Yep.
But they had the Dangerous Alliance to play off of. I mean, I don't know, man. I love the Horsemen, but to me there was always a weak link in the Horsemen.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I always remember the Dangerous Alliance more fondly, and maybe it's because I actually grew up watching the Dangerous Alliance.
Well, you know what? Me too. If I had to pick one, I'd pick the Dangerous Alliance. Yeah.
Yep. You know, which is what a great, just nasty bunch of heels. You know, they're all running together. They've got Pauly as their mouthpiece, and they've also got the female Medusa, who's just ruthless. And I mean, just what a great collection of heels. So you're so invested in the baby faces for all of those other reasons, but also because you hate this heel group so much. But really, for you and I, we didn't hate the heels. We fucking love them.
I love the heels.
Yeah. You basically got 10 guys that you're 100% invested in.
Except for Roddy Piper, all I liked when I first started wrestling was heels, you know?
Yep.
So
there you go. And just, you know, it's hard to go wrong in a War Games. It's just so It's so well structured. There have been there's a stinker or two, but the structure of the match lends itself to a hell of a lot of drama and a lot of action. That's another nice thing, is that you get a lot of action in those matches.
You do. It's a quasi battle royal sort of with all the action going on, all the arms and legs flying everywhere.
Yeah. So, great match. Great addition. I'm glad it got in this year.
Yeah, me too. Now I can stop pushing for it.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
My next thing is I got to get the Beverly Brothers into the fun wrestler category. That's my pet project for next year.
Oh. Which one was Bo?
He's the one in the the purple tights, right?
That's right. Okay, good. I'm glad you could remind me. All right.
Blonde-haired one.
Well, that's it for the 2011 Stunt Granny Akeem Memorial Hall of Fame induction for this year. I'm going to go ahead and get out of here. And so thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm going to pull a Jeremy. This is my impression of Jeremy from his last audio. Oh, my God, it's this part. Make sure you're following us on Twitter at Stunt Granny. I don't know if you listened to it yet, but he got to the end, and I think he had a panic attack because he knew he had to mention all the shit that we do online. And he goes, oh, my God, it's this part.
We're on, like, Twitter or whatever. It's at Granny. So follow us at Stunt Granny, and then follow all of our individual accounts on Twitter, too, because some of us use Twitter as our personal toilet bowl and dump whatever we want in there. That person might be me.
That's right. Let's see. Also, while you're listening to this audio one way or another, you might be downloading it from the website.
Yes.
If you know people who might find this thing interesting, but they're not really all that excited about going, they're not going to remember stuntgranny.com, or they're going to be fucking snobs about it, and they're not going to go to our site.
I love you, but I'm not in love with you. Those people can go to where?
They can go to iTunes, and they can download our audio at iTunes. Hey, how about that? So search for Stunt Granny on iTunes. You'll find these audios and so much more. Anyway, I think that's all we've got to pimp, so thanks again for checking us out. And we'll see you next year for the third annual Akeem Matt Hardy Memorial Stunt Granny Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's where we're headed for. And it might literally be Memorial that time.
Yeah.
For Eric Nelson, for Matt Hardy's Grace Site, I am Dusty Giebink. This has been another edition of Stunt Granny Audio. We will attempt to do better next time.
But does Granny really hate the wrestlers? Hardly.